We all come here because we have a spiritual practice or a mind training practice. And our reasons for doing that can be varied. Maybe, in fact, we come here because we like to hang out with this group, which is a pretty terrific reason. But what we constitute as a group is an unusual thing. By the way, the topic tonight is lay practice. And this group is a new phenomenon in the Buddhist world that's been around for, going on 26 centuries. We are a lay sangha. And to many Asian Buddhists, that's a contradiction in terms. That sangha, the group of people, were monastics. They were people who renounced the normal world and joined the monastic group exclusively. That's their life, at least for the period of time that they're under vows. So this phenomenon where we have a sangha that's composed of lay people is totally new. Leave it to the Americans, right? Mm-hmm. So what is it? What is it that we're practicing, and what do we take from the traditional, in fact, ancient Buddhism that can inform the way we go about this? We kind of have the cart before the horse here in the Western world. We generally start out with the third aspect of traditional lay practice. The formula is dana, sila, bhavana. Dana being generosity, sila, ethics, and bhavana, mind training, meditation. Using concentration, mindfulness, and wise effort to train the mind so that we can end suffering. More on that later. We are a lay sangha because we engage with the world. We engage with the world pretty much on its own terms. We go out and we earn money, we bring it home, we spend it as we're able, as we see fit. Whereas monastics, on an individual level, don't have anything to do with money. They don't touch it. We have intimate physical relationships, not for monastics. Look at all of the complications that come with money and with physical intimacy. Oy vey! This really makes life messy. And that's kind of the point. What the Buddha came up with 2,500 plus years ago is so counterintuitive that from that day forward, he had to completely cut off his normal life. He left his father's palace, left his wife, his newborn child, and went out into the world to dedicate 24/7 to seeking the end of suffering, liberation. And of course, that would set the pattern that his followers would do the same. 24/7, a life of seclusion. Now, even during the Buddha's lifetime, there were plenty of people who didn't want to do that, or who couldn't, for one reason or another. And he took them on as followers, as lay followers. And the funny thing was that as you read on in the suttas, the scriptures, you will find repeated assertions by the Buddha that a countless number of lay people had achieved enlightenment, nirvana, the burning out of the causes of suffering. So we have it on pretty good authority that it's not necessary to live a monastic life. There are certainly advantages to it, and sometimes it's referred to as the fast track. If you really want to achieve nirvana in this lifetime, go to a monastery and take vows and just work on it all the time. Well, I know from personal experience that it's possible to work on it all the time and still handle money and have intimate relationships and wear, you know, normal clothes and keep your hair, sort of a thing. I probably have not been able to achieve a lot of meditative accomplishments that I would have had I been in a monastery. Although, you know, when I was in Asia, I visited some monasteries, and they are not quiet, calm places. In fact, even Spirit Rock isn't quiet and calm. Be sitting there in the meditation hall when the turkeys decide it's time to have a squabble, and there's nothing quiet about it. What we have, our advantage as lay people, is the very complexity that the life of seclusion avoids. We have lots of opportunity to study suffering. Which brings me to the beginning of the lay practice as it was laid out in the suttas, ostensibly by the Buddha, beginning with generosity, and then going on to ethics, and then going on to meditation. So the big question is, why? And the reason is that generosity opens the heart. I like to think of that as opening the door of the cage of our self-interest, the cage of our identities. Now, it's just a coincidence that tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, I'm going to be teaching very similar stuff to 32 college kids. And it's a course on world conflict. What is conflict? But another word for dukkha. D-U-K-K-H-A. Suffering. Dukkha. Dissatisfaction. Not being in harmony with things as they are. And a lot of the disharmony, a lot of the conflict that we have in our own minds, our own psyches, and in the world, among and between people, comes from identities. And the misfitting between our identity and what is our heart's deepest desire, what makes us truly comfortable in life. We impose identities on ourselves through our idea of self and our idea of what is going to make that self happy. Usually, we think of it in terms of a fleeting kind of pleasure, getting something that we've wanted for a long time, being able to feel, taste, smell, whatever it is, enjoy it in that way. Even an accomplishment is that kind of a pleasure that is fleeting and we build ourselves around it. Not just accomplishments, but the getting of things, the status symbols, the illusion of security. I want to get things so I can be secure. Well, I just was reading in the New Yorker last week about the Cascadia subduction zone, which is likely to take all of California and put it in the ocean. So, security, you know, not so secure. You can have a huge bank account and something like that happens. And you look at geological time, it does happen. There's no predicting, really, what the future is going to bring. So when we practice generosity, we are practicing opening the door to this cage that we have constructed out of our ideas of who we are or ought to be and what we want and what we think is going to make us happy. If only I had that. If only I could accomplish this or that, I would be happy. And it locks us in to dissatisfaction. Because whatever we want, we don't have. So we're not happy right now. It's the only time we really can be happy. So when we give, we are shifting our attention, our interest, our focus away from this self, this identity construct, to other beings. And that's how the cage door opens. We think about someone else instead of ourselves. Every moment we spend not thinking about ourselves is progress. And I'm not saying that generosity means we have to destitute ourselves or our families or give away so much that we can't get along in life. I'm talking about cultivating the spirit of caring about other people. And also recognizing that we are part of all beings. When we care for any other beings, we're essentially caring for ourselves. And we know this. We're beginning to see this in the really big picture of planetary ecology. When we're selfish and we decide we're going to cut down that forest because it's going to improve our bottom line, we degrade the living conditions all around the planet. And we do this on a small scale in our own lives when we feed the greed at the expense of generosity. And what's one of the three causes of suffering, of dukkha? Greed, along with hatred and delusion. We all know the suffering that comes with hatred. You can feel it when you're feeling hatred. But if you pay close attention, greed has that same feeling. And it can sometimes raise its ugly head when we're trying to decide whether or not we're going to be generous, if we're going to give something. And that's why we've got a basket here to give each one of us the opportunity to see how it works when we contemplate giving. At the moment that we decide to give, we have this, it's almost a feeling of relief, because the part of us that's clinging to it has been vanquished. In that moment when I decide I'm going to give my teacher, you know, whatever it is for the half day or whatever I've spent with him. There's a feeling of, oh, great, I've got that money. I can afford to give that money away and to give it to Gil and all the wonderful things that he and IMC are building. And in the moment when I actually do it, it's a feeling of gladness because I know that I've helped. I know that I've helped give an unnamed, unknowable number of people the gift of these teachings. And in a way, that's the best form of generosity that there is. Now, I can remember one time I was walking down the street and a mother and 20-year-old daughter were kind of, they're starting to bicker with each other. I don't have a quarter. No, don't you have a quarter? No. Why didn't you think to bring a quarter? They were dealing with the parking meter. And they didn't have it. They were, you know, going to run the risk of getting a parking ticket. So I happened to remember I had a quarter right in my pocket. I reached in, and I didn't know them, said, here's a quarter. And they were very happy to have it. I was very happy to be able to help them, and I walked on. I don't know, maybe I modeled generosity for them. That would be great. When we give people things that please them, it's great. But if that's all we can do, then it's a little like if someone is sick, and instead of giving them medicine, we give them candy. If the medicine is at hand, and you know it's the right medicine for the illness, give them that. And I think that's why I was motivated to become a teacher. After seeing that what I had learned and practiced could be shared on this deeper level, that's really what I wanted to do. There are different levels of generosity, and they all open the heart. And the most important level, I think, is the level at which we hope that all beings will find freedom from their suffering. And not just that they're going to get a new bicycle or whatever they're wanting. Now, if you've ever given a kid the bicycle that he or she is longing for, you know it's wonderful. And it will last for several weeks. But if you help someone learn how to end suffering, it's going to last forever. So that is the spirit that comes from generosity. And it doesn't have to be money in the Donna basket, although, you know, it helps us stay here, pay the rent, or pay the Donna onto the church. It can be giving somebody a quarter if they don't have it for the meter. It can be any kind of helping. The most important thing, though, is opening the heart. Because when the heart is open, we practice our meditation in a different way. The Mahayana tradition makes a big deal of practicing for the benefit of all beings. And we dedicate the merit here that whatever good comes from our practice should go to the benefit of all beings. But this is an idea that it's very important to incorporate in our practice right from the beginning. Because if there's any sense that I can cultivate and keep the benefits of this practice for myself, it's kind of two steps forward and one step back. We can't. And it doesn't do us any good to want to. Ethics, I'm going to run through that one pretty quickly. But you can kind of see that ethics is a tremendous gift that we can give to all the world. One of safety from the consequences of, in my case, my own misconduct. You know, going back to world conflict, one of the things that most annoys us about being in society is the way other people behave. And when we adhere to basic common sense principles of ethics, we don't bug other people quite so much. You know, we give them the gift of a better day than they would have if we just go around blurting out whatever nasty thing we think of in reactivity to whatever they're doing. Now, I had the benefit of spending the first 23 years of my practice without having to work, without having to have a job. So I'm really glad now that I have a job, that I bring to it all of those years of being able to come back to my understanding of the precepts. Not to kill, not to lie, not to steal, not to abuse sexual energy, and not to abuse intoxicants that cloud the mind. Now, the big one for all of us is harsh speech. And that's, you know, the lying. But also in the Eightfold Path, right speech is 1/8 of it. And when I'm in the classroom, it's not like being here in the Sangha. I want very much to teach the students what they're there to learn. I really care about them. My heart is open. But they can be pains in the neck. And not my first class, but at any rate, it happens. There are students in that classroom who aren't quite clear on why they're there. And they can give me some trouble. And fortunately, combined with my sincere desire for them to have well-being, and my constant reminders to watch my tongue, to not speak out of anger or dislike, I'm able to come back pretty quickly to, yeah, that's right, I really want this person to do well. And to run on that makes the day much more pleasant for me, and I'm sure for the rest of the class. Because, you know, I don't need to give them a lesson in conflict by participating in it myself. So there is a logical progression from dana to sila, from generosity to ethics. And when we have both of these established and our relationship with the world is on an open-hearted, kind basis, it's much easier for us to do our mind training. I know when I sit down to meditate after being really, really angry about something, that's all I can think about is the anger until I can let it go. Until I can open my heart and have some understanding from where the other person might have been coming from, or at least the understanding that my carrying that grudge isn't going to do me or anyone else any good. Then the mind can settle down. So that's why for traditional lay practice, generosity and ethics were put first, to condition the mind and the heart for the benefits of meditation, of using mindfulness and concentration, and of course my favorite, the Four Wise Efforts, which boil down basically to a two-pronged principle, which I think is best expressed by Thich Nhat Hanh: water the flowers, not the weeds. Encourage the thoughts that lead to serenity and positive feelings and thoughts, and take the energy away from the thoughts, the mind states that lead to suffering for yourself and others. So I'm eager to hear whatever stories you have about using lay practice, these three pillars of our practice, in the complicated lives that we live here outside of the monastery. Thank you.